I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. I am doing a solo AMA today, and the reason is that the guest that I had originally scheduled had to reschedule. So I'm going to be here all alone, so lonely, hoping that you will be sending in your questions and comments and giving me material to exercise my wit and my genius, my humor, whatever. So let us begin. I have a question from Alice. Alice asks, what are your thoughts on the Alex Jones Sandy Hook judgment? Alex Jones has been hit with nearly $50 million in damages from a couple families of the Sandy Hook massacre victims. And basically, the whole pretext of this was that Alex Jones spearheaded this, what I think is crazy and contemptible, barking, mad mob that was claiming that the Sandy Hook thing was a hoax. Practically every mass shooting and bombing and things like that that comes along is a hoax. I find it incredibly cringeworthy and disgusting. And I despise Alex Jones. I really despise Alex Jones. I can't think of many people in the media that I have more contempt for than Alex Jones. And that includes the mainstream. I think Rachel Maddow is probably more honest and honorable than Alex Jones. And that's saying something, okay? That said, this is obviously just an attempt to target dissidents for silencing through lawfare, and it shouldn't happen. I should think that these things were covered by the First Amendment. Again, I think the things that he chooses to say are often despicable and cringeworthy, and they basically are corruptive of the minds of the people who follow him. And apparently, he makes a whole lot of money off these marks, these suckers, these fans. So he can afford to pay $50 million nearly if he has to, and I'm sure that judgment will be reduced. But yeah, the whole thing strikes me as basically the use of lawfare to infringe upon the First Amendment rights of dissident figures in much the same way as the legal harassment to basically protesters and participants in the Charlottesville Unite the Right rally has been simply an attempt to use lawfare to punish and discourage people from exercising their right to speak and assemble. And it needs to be stopped. I don't know how to stop this exactly. Surely the law could be rewritten so it's not so easily abused in such a transparent way. That's what needs to be done. But you know, Alex Jones deserves some kind of comeuppance because he's a reckless liar. And the people who had the horror of losing their children were later subjected to the years of horror of being targeted by these mobs of crazy people stirred up by Alex Jones. So I sympathize with these victims. However, I don't think Alex Jones can be penalized for his freedom of speech. Maybe some of the people who harassed these families could be charged with some form of actual harassment that's not protected by freedom of speech. But I don't think Alex Jones is not protected by the First Amendment. I think this is an important case. I hope it's appealed. I hope these judgments are overturned. And I hope that further cases like this are discouraged. So that's my thoughts about the Alex Jones case. That's a good question. Thank you very much, Alice. Okay, Sutton asks, will you embrace Laura Loomer as your sister in Christ when you meet her at AMREN this year? Okay, well, I will be at AMREN this year, and Laura Loomer is going to be one of the speakers, and I think that's pretty interesting. And I will certainly, if I speak to her, be extremely polite to her. I will shake her hand and be polite because, well, she's Jared's guest and I'll be Jared's guest. And it's Jared's house and I'm going to be polite in Jared's house. And we can be cordial and polite with people even if we have principal disagreements with them. So I'm going to be a real gentleman when I see Laura Loomer and if I interact with her at AMREN. So let's just put that issue aside, because the real issue that you're sort of angling at here, Sutton, is what do I think of Laura becoming a Christian? Because I'm not a Christian, so she's not my sister in Christ in the first place, and you know that. So anyway, what are my thoughts on Laura Loomer converting to Christianity? Well, I don't know what's in her heart, but I just want to point out something here. There are people who have taken me aside when I have rolled my eyes at the sectarianism of the Nick Fuentes America First crowd. And they said, Greg, you have to understand this stuff about Christian nationalism. It's just to keep the Jews out. It's kryptonite to Jews. And I always laughed at that because, of course, it's not kryptonite. Because it turns out that the guy who helped Nick set up his America First Foundation is a Jew and a Jewish scam artist on top of that. And now we have Laura Loomer. Well, we have Milo. Milo has been baptized. And not only is he no longer Jewish, he's no longer gay. That holy water has amazing therapeutic magical powers. And Laura Loomer is now a Christian too. And so the people who say that this Christian nationalist branding, you know, it's Greg, it's just a way of sort of saying non-Jewish, right? That's just not true. It doesn't wash. It doesn't stand up. It's silly. So I don't know what's in Laura Loomer's heart. I don't presume to say, but I just want to say that the idea that Christianity can be a bulwark for white people separating them from non-whites is obviously false. And I want to thank Laura for helping prove that, make that point so salient in the recent news cycle. So thank you, Laura. Thank you for proving that. It's a good thing because a lot of people are sold at least to go along with Christian nationalism or keep their mouths shut about it or pretend like it really is some sort of panacea, when it's obviously not. It's not a impermeable barrier that white people can set up against outsiders. In fact, it's one of the original ways that barriers between whites and non-whites have been broken down. And the most fundamental barrier is the genetic barrier, and the church has always celebrated mixed marriages. It's really, really interesting. If you go back to the late Middle Ages and the Renaissance, and you look at Adoration of the Magi paintings, have you noticed the pattern? Have you noticed that Adoration of the Magi paintings from the Renaissance look like the covers of college catalogs today? What do I mean by that? I mean that in the Renaissance and late Middle Ages, when people were painting the three kings, they would portray one of them as a very black African. And then there would be a couple of guys who looked vaguely white, maybe one a little more oriental than the other, right? A little more Middle Eastern than the other, maybe wearing a turban or something. And it was one of each. It was diversity. Now, as far as I know, there's no biblical basis, if the Magi existed, et cetera, for thinking that one of them would be black. And in fact, calling them Magi, wise men, that is a term that would not include blacks. They weren't part of the Magian civilization, right? They wouldn't have come from the East, for one thing. So it's just an expression of Christian globalism, Christian universalism, Christian multiracialism, even before there were many black Christians at all. And I think that that's a very interesting fact. So Adoration of the Magi paintings were basically multiracialist propaganda while Europe was still overwhelmingly white and had almost zero contact with black people. I don't even know where these people got their idea of what black people look like. I guess there were a few, but yeah, they're actually portrayed there. So I do think that the allegation that we can simply use Christian as a proxy for white, that thesis is bunk. And if you're being sold that thesis, it doesn't stand up. And that means that we can't soft pedal white. We can't soft pedal white by talking about European civilization or Western civilization or Christendom, because those are not coextensive with the category of white, and they don't keep out the people that we would like to keep out. So we've got to talk about race. We can't avoid talking about race. Civilization isn't enough because, you know, you can assimilate one or two or three people from other races into your civilization. And if all you're concerned about is civilization, why can't you imagine basically replacing the founding population of your civilization with a new group of people who hold on to the same values, right? That's civic nationalism. That's the great replacement. That's racial nihilism from our point of view. Now, the other question comes from Miko. And Miko's question is Christian nationalism an op? I guess this is a claim that's being spread around in our circles. For instance, our very own Jim Goad, who's a very wise guy, he thinks that there's something weird and suspicious about the promotion of people like E. Michael Jones and Nick Fuentes in what was the alt-right circles, which was very much united around white identity politics. Why is this other overlapping but not entirely compatible worldview being pushed into our spheres? Some people have raised that question. I don't think it's an op so much. Well, I mean, there are people trying to do it, obviously. But the question is it an intentional thing to distract people from white identity politics? Or is it just people trying to proselytize in any old way they can? That's something that Christians are commanded to do. They're commanded to proselytize. And I think that that's partly what's going on here. I think part of it is the attempt to link a declining religion, and Christianity is declining in the United States, especially amongst younger people, to a vital movement that attracts younger people. It's trying to get these younger people excited about Christianity on the assumption that it's somehow the same as the stuff that they're really concerned with. Maybe so. I mean, there's definitely some proselytizing going on here. The question is it an attempt to subvert, or is it just, you know, sectarianism raising its ugly head, people trying to combine white identity politics with other add-on items, things like that? I don't know. I do think, however, that raising the question, is it an op, invites one to ask these people, well, what exactly do you think white identity politics is going to be like? Where exactly do you think Christians are going to fit in to white identity politics? Because if your vision of white identity politics is that it's something that basically consists of, oh, I don't know, neo-pagans and Nietzscheans and Richard Spencer, and, you know, the alt-MSNBC, as Hunter Wallace likes to say, Apollonians. If you think that that's what white identity politics is going to be, then you're engaged in sectarianism and LARPing and just lost in fantasy. Because white identity politics is definitely going to have a huge component of people who are believing Christians in it, right? I've argued this for years, that in majority Christian countries, and even in post-Christian countries, you're going to find that a significant percentage of people engaged in white identity politics are going to be Christian. That's going to be their culture. That's going to be their religion. To whatever extent they practice it, they're going to identify as Christian. And it would be the height of self-defeating folly to brand white identity politics as a sectarianly anti-Christian movement. This is why I've tried to argue against sectarianism in general. The idea of a functional movement that I put forward is that we simply have to be united around the things that unite us, which are white interests, white identity, stopping the Great Replacement. And when people try to inject things that are divisive, like coffee versus tea nationalism, or pagan versus Christian, or Catholic versus Protestant, or whatever, these are add-on items. And if you want to insist that these add-on items are suddenly going to be absolutely necessary to participate in this movement, then what you're engaged in is the rookie error of sectarianism, and you're going to split the movement. Now, a lot of people will do that because what they really want is not a vast and growing great wave of white nationalism, a great wave of white identity politics that's rising up and is going to be the wave of the future and sweep away all opposition. They don't want that so much as they want to be the king of a little fiefdom, a little domain, a little audience, because we're talking about people who are primarily producing media content, right? We're talking about businessmen. We're talking about businessmen who are trying to manage and monetize pay pigs. They're pay pig farmers, right? And how do you keep your little piggies away from those little piggies over there? Well, you come up with some kind of wedge issue between you and other people who are in the white identity politics sphere to try and basically isolate your pay piggies from their pay piggies and maybe get some of their little piggies to come over to your trough so you can fatten them up and eat the bacon, as Nick Fuentes said so blandly and sinisterly. That's a motivation for sectarianism. Sectarians use sectarian wedge issues to try and create audiences that they can then monetize and lord over. And even if they're not monetizing it, they're definitely, definitely high on the adulation, right? They get off on the adulation. It's a cult of personality. And let me tell you something, folks. Cults of personality never happen by accident. They always happen because people want them to happen. They cultivate them actively. If there's a cult of personality forming, that's because there's a needy, narcissistic cult leader who's cultivating that. And he's got a little fringe of sycophants around him who are trying to cultivate that too, because they get off on being close to the center as well. So we have to step back here and just ask ourselves, what did we envision victory looking like? Did we envision victory looking like everybody adoring, everybody being an Apollonian, or everybody loving Nick Fuentes? No, those are foolish visions of victory, and they're not going to happen. A vision of victory is going to be that white people up and down the political spectrum, religious and non-religious and of every religious denomination and flavor and level of commitment, right? All of these people become more racially aware and more willing to take their own side in ethnic struggles. That's how victory happens. When our ideas become hegemonic across the society and sectarianism gets in the way of that. And I have to restrain my sectarian tendencies, and other people need to restrain their sectarian tendencies. We should not set up litmus tests that are not essential to what white identity politics is about, which is white identity, white survival, white flourishing, stopping the great replacement, regaining control over our homelands and our destinies, etc. That's what it's really about. There's a tendency that people have, though, when they see something happening, and oftentimes this thing that's happening is a media manufactured phenomenon, or if it's not entirely manufactured by the media, it's something out there organic that people in the media want to puff up, they want to fluff it up, they want to trot it out and expose everybody to it. For what reason? Well, obviously their agenda, which is inimical to white people, makes certain phenomena attractive. Now, we have a big kerfuffle of a panic that's being raised about Christian nationalism. Why is that? Well, I think that people on the left, people in the media, they're all basically the same thing. They want to gin up hysteria, gin up. They want to get their voters out. They want to get them engaged. They've tried to do this with Roe versus Wade. They're going to try and do this with Christian nationalism. They're going to try and manufacture this into a threat that will motivate them. Like the fascist Trump was created, basically, as a threat to mobilize the left. And it mobilized the left to the point where women were walking around dressed like vaginas. I'll never forget that. And I'll always love Donald Trump for at least being the guy who got feminists to go parading around dressed as vaginas. That will never be undone. That is part of the permanent record of the universe now. And Donald Trump deserves credit for that. I wish he built the wall, but the pussy hat is still something that gives me joy to this very day. Okay, so I do think that one of the tendencies that happens in our cause is that when something gets whipped up that's not really our thing, but it's sort of close to it, people think, we need to get on board. We need to get on board this thing and maybe get out in front of it and put our spin on it, you know, make a racist spin on this. I think part of that's boredom. People get excited when the latest thing comes along. It's also opportunism and stuff like that. We were hearing these arguments with COVID protests and things like that. People were saying the white nationalist spirit needs to set aside all this talk about the Great Replacement and dedicate ourselves to fighting against COVID tyranny and lockdowns. And my reaction to that was no. Honestly, we don't need to do that and we shouldn't do that. Why? Well, two reasons why. One, it's not our issue. And if we can't take our own side on our own political ideological issues, how do we expect to teach our people to take their own side on ethnic conflicts, right? If we're so willing to just sort of drop and shelve our main mission so that we can go and pick up other people's banners because, well, that's where the action is. That's where the clicks are coming from. That's where the views are coming from. How serious are we, right? And the other reason why we shouldn't be doing this is because other people are doing it. Other people, blue-pilled or purple-pilled normies, are doing this. They don't need us to do this. We shouldn't be spending our scarce capital basically going out and cheering for things that are not us, that don't really advance our cause. And so I think that to the extent that Christian nationalism is a thing, and yeah, it's a thing, I don't think people who don't primarily think of themselves as Christians need to get involved in this. And the danger of this, and the extent to which people, I think, feel threatened by it in our movement and are tempted to call it an op, is that it does appeal to a certain weak personality type that gets basically caught up in anything that's sort of in our field or sort of right-wing or sort of reactionary, and it's the latest thing, and they want to get involved in that. And so what it does is it pulls away these people. It's the latest thing, and they want to get involved. And somehow they think that by submerging our message into something that's not really the same thing and is in some ways incompatible, will make us stronger. And it doesn't make us stronger. It makes us weaker. And there are plenty of people who call themselves Christian nationalists where if you want to help carry their cross, so to speak, they'll definitely let you carry their cross and carry their water and so forth and write them checks and things like that. But if you try and inject racial issues into it, they will turn on you and drive you away, denounce you. And you gain nothing at that point. You've invested your time, your money, your hope. And as soon as you make a peep about white interests, all of that will mean nothing and you will be driven out and it will be a waste of time. It's the same with COVID protesting and things like that, or being on the side of the Palestinians. If you go to pro-Palestinian protests and then you try and raise our issues, you will be driven away like that. You gain nothing by that kind of behavior. So I, to that extent, I do think it's a problem. Now, there's also a kind of discourse that floats around in the right, and it's been going on for a very long time. This goes back centuries, thousands of years. Basically, it's this. One of the ways that established religions try and maintain control over society is they want to suppress dissent. Okay? And if they have the power to physically suppress dissent, punish dissenters, imprison them, kill them, do things like that, they'll do that. And if they don't have the power to physically, legally suppress dissent, what do they do? How do they suppress dissent? Well, one of the ways that they suppress dissent is they go out and they appeal to things other than actual belief in the dominant religion. They'll go to people who are lukewarm or simple non-believers, and they'll say, you know, Odinism is the cement that holds society together. Your lovely wife will make you a sandwich only if she thinks that Odin wants her to make that sandwich. Your lovely wife will only be faithful to you if she thinks that Odin wants her to be faithful to you. Your lovely children will only obey you and grow up to be decent people if they think Odin wants that, et cetera, et cetera. So I know you have some doubts about Odin, but the smart thing to do, you think you're so smart. You think you see through this religion. You think it's arbitrary. You think it's baseless. You think you're so smart. But if you're really smart, you're going to go along with it. You're going to be quiet. You're going to go along with it. Why? Because it's the cement of society and you want to be a good citizen. And in fact, you can feel really, really smart by pulling the wool over all of our eyes, by pretending to believe in something that you don't believe. They sell that. They sell that. And they let intellectuals, doubters actually believe that they're the ones who are pulling the wool over the eyes of the believers. When really that whole mentality is a way of hoodwinking them. It's a way of getting them to feel smart while getting them to go along with things that they don't believe in, suppressing dissent. There's a whole lot of that kind of discourse in the right today. There are a lot of people who are non-believers. There are a lot of people who are agnostics. There are a lot of people who just don't find religion interesting at all. And Christians in these circles will say, you really should just fool the normies. Fool the normies. It's the enlightened thing to do. Fool the normies by going along with this because it's better for society. Really, it's the way that they fool non-believers into keeping the illusion going, keeping a sphere where these ideas are dominant. There's this term that comes out of Leo Strauss, esoteric writing, esotericism, where the idea is that philosophers throughout history have always been at odds with the dominant reigning opinions of their societies, and those generally include the religions of the society. Those are the most dominant things. That's the stuff that's sacred, right? What's held to be sacred is the most dominant idea of a society or set of beliefs. And if you're a philosopher and you are at odds with that, out of prudence, you will hide your beliefs and only disclose them in subtle hints between the lines, right? And so to read ancient philosophers and medieval philosophers and even modern philosophers, you've got to be attentive to how they're hoodwinking the masses by pretending to go along with the dominant religion of the time when they're really free thinkers, right? I think that whole worldview, it could be manufactured by free thinkers who just want to survive, but it also could be manufactured by religious apologists who just want to find some way of neutralizing any kind of public dissent against their dominant religion. So there's always a question when this comes up of who's fooling whom here. And I think a lot of people in our circles are engaged in that. There's one guy, Way of the World. You know, I've seen his videos and I've seen his social media stuff, and he was really leaning into the more paranoid, heavy breathing stuff when it was COVID time. I recently saw a tweet where he was going all in on Christian nationalism. He was saying, they're not anti-white. The real thing the enemy is anti-Christian. And I just rolled my eyes and just thought, goodbye to this fool. Farewell to this bozo, right? I had tuned him out on COVID. I tuned back in, and this was like the third thing I thought from him. Rest in peace, Bozo. Trav LeBlanc, who used to be a Countercurrents writer, was sounding off the same kind of stuff. Now, I don't know what's in people's hearts, but I have a strong feeling that some of these people are fooling themselves, or they're trying to fool others. They're going along with something they don't believe in because they think it's the going thing and it's the winning strategy. I think that that's problematic, and I try to discourage that. I want to discourage that as much as possible. But again, the people who think that Christian nationalism is some sort of sinister outsider operation to overthrow what? Apollinianism? That's silly. If that's your vision of victory, you're just LARPing. You're always going to be on the internet, and I'm always going to be ignoring you. Right? The only reasonable vision of victory that I can see is if our ideas become hegemonic, and that means that Christian and non-Christian alike adopt them. And that's how we win, not by having sectarian Christian versus non-Christian struggles. And that sectarianism comes from both ends. Okay, so that's a long speech, but thank you for both of those questions, Miko and Sutton. Okay, so Gaddius writes in with $10. What are your thoughts about college? Well, this is in response to an ongoing conversation with Scott Greer on Twitter and people who mostly who don't have IQs of 187 like Scott. Yeah, Scott's got, you know, maybe 50 IQ points advantage on me. So I hesitate to disagree with him on any of this, but what are my thoughts on college? Well, my thoughts on college are this. In a normal, healthy society, a small percentage of people, 5% maybe, would go to college. These would be people who are going on to jobs that require a college education as a preparation for certain careers. What kind of careers? Well, professional careers, and also teaching, being intellectuals, things like that. That kind of college education is really essential. Who shouldn't be going to college? Well, vast numbers of people shouldn't be going to college to get degrees in things like hotel management, which is a very different degree from restaurant management, by the way. It's very different. You can't conflate those two things. You'll make certain people extremely upset because those are completely different things, we're told. You're not going to go and get degrees in gender studies or Black studies or Latino, Latina, or Latinx studies. You're not going to be getting degrees in that kind of stuff because it's useless. A vast number of degrees that are handed out in universities today are useless. Why are so many people going to universities for useless degrees? The main reason is this. Getting a college degree is a proxy for an IQ test. And since employers are discouraged or not even allowed to just plop down an IQ test in front of an 18-year-old who's about to graduate from school and find out who's the smartest kid in the class and then offer to train him to have a great job in this particular industry or that industry, because they're not allowed to do something like that, they have to let these kids go off and undertake 4 or 5 years of college at ruinous and inflating expense just to get a degree, which is basically nothing more than a proxy for an IQ test that could have been administered for very little money, for no money at all, in an hour or two. That's what most college degrees are. They're simply proxies for IQ tests. And of course, when more people realize this, more people want to get in, and then we have to have diversity because all people are equal. And so the value of the degree as a proxy for an IQ test plummets. It goes down and down and down. Of course, a lot of people in college don't learn anything. They don't learn anything healthy and good in, say, liberal arts classes. They learn mind-bending, gender-bending, soul-crushing ideologies and lies. And so I can't really recommend that people go to college in society today. In a healthy society, a certain number of people should go to college. But going to college in today's society is basically undertaking a very expensive course in, well, basically you're being assaulted, subverted, and your time is wasted, and a huge amount of debt is being accrued. And you're lucky to come out of it a sane whole person anymore. There are all these before after pictures of attractive young girls who go off to college, and after a couple of years, they've metamorphosed into hideous monsters with, you know, black lipstick, and that's the least of it, and facial piercings and stuff like that. It's just grotesque. Why is this happening? How is this happening? That's what they're being educated in. So I think that most higher education in America today is worthless. And if it's not worthless, it's beyond worthless. It's actually harmful. So what do you do if you want to be socially upwardly mobile? Well, if you need a college degree to become a doctor or a lawyer, or if you want to try and do the march through the institutions, you're going to have to do it. There are ways that you can insulate yourself as much as possible from that. You should try to insulate yourself as much as possible from this indoctrination. It's still going to be ruinously expensive. Maybe you can get scholarships and not come out of it indebted. But I have a PhD, and if I were 18 years old and contemplating going to college today and looking at what Scott Greer's saying, I'd just say, I don't care how smart you are, Scott. It's not a good risk. If I were mature enough to say that at the age of 18, I would be mature enough to have an alternative plan. What kind of alternative plan? Well, basically to find a way of creating a business for myself. If I were 18 and contemplating the rest of my life, I would contemplate creating a business for myself, which is what I did in the end anyway, because all of my education didn't suit me for a career that, you know, that required my degrees that I got, right? I ended up going into academia briefly, leaving academia, and making my own way in the world. And maybe if I had done that when I was younger, I would be a lot further ahead. I would have wasted a lot less time. Now, when I was in college, though, I have to say, and this is self-congratulatory, I saw the emptiness of a lot of the stuff that was on offer even then, way back when college was not so bad. And I steered away from that because I was always a self-starter and a person seeking challenges. I steered away from the slop and the drivel and the politics. And I took classes that were hard. I took a lot of hard classes. And I even, you know, and this is very foolish looking back on it, I even spent 5 years as an undergraduate. I was just grabbing off so much stuff. But if you really look for it, you can find extremely challenging good classes. And then I was doing a lot of reading on my own. So I got a lot out of college despite the university system. And when I went to graduate school, I had the great good fortune of going to an excellent graduate school that I didn't have to fight against to learn a whole lot from. And even then, I learned a whole lot more. So if you go to college, you've got to be an autodidact. Even if you go to college, you've got to be a self-starter. The system won't educate you. You can use it as an occasion to educate yourself. But you know, if I had decided to go into business on my own at the age of 18 and figured out a career and a path and an income, I probably would have pretty much been able to educate myself in the same way that I did with going to college. It would have been slower because I would have been working more, but I would have been further ahead in my life and maybe far more effectual at doing what I'm doing now if I had gone that route. So you can't really say blanket yes or no, go to college. It really depends. A lot of people who go to college are not helped by it. Honestly, if you have a daughter and she's 18 years old, don't send her to college. Even if she's got a college fund, don't send her to college. There's a terrible chance that she'll be turned into a monster that you won't recognize. If she's got a college fund, use it as a dowry. Try and marry her off to some good man. Seriously, that's what I would recommend to almost all women is when they're young, focus on just getting married and starting a family. You're better suited when you're young. You got more energy. You got more genetic errors that accumulate over time and that are problems. So you've got to, I would recommend highly that girls and women be just slotted, even very intelligent ones, be slotted towards motherhood and family. You can do that very intelligently, you can benefit from that. And with young men, I really think that parents should be very, very realistic and sit down with them and figure out, you know, what they can do. And if they are going to be that doctor or a lawyer or something, then yeah, send them to college. But if they're just searching to find themselves, that's a terrible reason to go to college, to find yourself. If you go to college to find yourself, you will often lose yourself and you will lose a lot of time and you'll lose a lot of money too. Surely there are better ways that people can find themselves than racking up ruinous amounts of debt and subjecting oneself to mind-destroying, hateful propaganda. Surely there are other ways of doing that. And yeah, maybe you want to take your kid's college fund and send him to Europe or something. There are lots of different ways of finding yourself besides going to college. There are a lot of different ways of figuring out what you want to do with your life besides going to college that are less expensive and less damaging. So I guess it depends on your vision for yourself. But the idea that if you're a middle-class person, it's just going to be expected that you're going to be filling out college applications and going to college, I think we need to get rid of that expectation. The truth is that it might make your life harder if you want to apply for these jobs where you're going to sit in an office and be a drone, right? Work at the corporation and things like that. If that's the height of your ambition, then maybe you should do it. But if you don't know what you want to do, and it's just expected that you're going to go off to college for 4 years or so, I would resist that. And I think parents need to change that expectation too. I think there'd be a lot less mischief. Does this mean that people on the right are going to disempower themselves from getting college jobs? Well, jobs that the college educated get? Well, yeah, that's kind of dicey. It also means that we're going to avoid having our daughters turned into monsters on Instagram. You know, there are pros and cons to this. It's not entirely good or bad, one way or the other. And it depends on the person. It really depends on the person. I would definitely say don't send your daughters to college. Even if they don't marry and become mothers, there are plenty of more useful things they can do than go to college for 4 years and then be a barista with a huge amount of debt or something like that. You can just start out at Starbucks, right? So yeah, those are my thoughts on that. Thank you, Gadius. I appreciate the donation. And maybe Scott Greer will respond to this. I don't know. So let's see if there are any more questions here. Michael has written in with $15. The sectarian problem with Christians isn't just Christianity versus pagan. It's real Christian sect versus all the fake Christian sects due to the very Jewish nature of the Abrahamic religions. Each sect believes it alone, believes in the one true God and worships him in the one true way, and the others are false. Hail the God. I mean, yeah, that's true. But one of the funny things that makes me think that a lot of this Christian nationalist stuff isn't all that seriously Christian, and it's just, I don't know, it's politics. Basically, it's politics. Is that if these guys who are suddenly saying, we're all going to become Orthodox Christians because that is the most metal of faiths, and this will be our vehicle. This is the most Warhammer 40K of Christian denominations, and that's going to be our vehicle to create the Christian Taliban. But, you know, if you're Catholic, you're okay. Well, no, if you really believe this stuff, it's not okay to be Catholic. It's not okay to be Presbyterian or vice versa. If you really believe this stuff, you've got to anathematize all the other Christian denominations, but they don't, right? Or if they do, I don't hear about it. They're all willing to work with different Christian denominations. And then you have to say, well, what about pagans? And then they'll say, well, you know, well, maybe we can bring some pagans. And, you know, it's at that point, it just goes out the window. So, I do think that that is another factor here. And the fact that there's less of that Christian versus Christian sectarianism means that there's already a great deal of realpolitik that's dictating all of this, right? Well, if you're going to let realpolitik dictate things, why don't you just let it dictate you right out of branding this Christian to begin with and just talk about nationalism? If you want a bigger tent, just talk about nationalism. It's a good question. It's a good point. Thank you, Michael. I appreciate your donation. Way of the World is on the pro-white side. Don't fight with other pro-whites. No, I'm going to fight with him because I don't think he's pro-white. If he's saying, no, the real issue is Christianity and whiteness is only, the establishment isn't anti-white so much as it's anti-Christian, that's obviously distorting the message on the most important thing. So yeah, I'll quote-unquote fight with him. DDS Waterloo writes in, education is largely worthless now. It's credentialism and it's become big business. Yeah, credentials still can be valuable, but the question is, you've got to go into it with your eyes open about that and you've got to actually be able to educate yourself and you've got to be able to shelter yourself from the insanity and the indoctrination. And if you're not able to do that, if you're not prepared to do that, and if you're a parent and you're not preparing your children to do that, it's irresponsible to send them to college. Archie writes in, university education is an indoctrination camp. Yes, wandering through the university's library exposed me to more ideas than a curriculum could. Exactly. Hadrian was right, writes in, there's an occasional exception like St. John's College in Annapolis that focuses exclusively on antiquity and the classics for 4 years, I think. Not sure about the faculty, the reading lists are great. I actually interviewed at one of the St. John's campuses, and a friend of mine who had interviewed there before me basically said it was Maria Montessori meets Mortimer Adler. Now, what is that? Well, Mortimer Adler was the great books guy, and of course, St. John's has a great books curriculum. You read all the classics. And who is Maria Montessori? Well, she was a pioneer of progressive education for children, where the children are just sort of allowed to, you know, play on their own. And the St. John's colleges are sort of like Montessori school because the students sort of fumble around and educate themselves while the teachers sit there benignly presiding over these seminars without interjecting anything, including corrections to the most elementary errors that can get the whole discussion off on the wrong foot. So yeah, there's something wonderful about the St. John's reading list, but I can't imagine a more perverse and self-defeating method of education than to have credentialed experts sitting there silent while the students fumble around and waste a lot of time talking about things. And, you know, they're supposed to educate themselves. I'm sorry. Well, you know, why don't they just take the reading list on their own and educate themselves for all the good that these seminars do them. So yeah, those are my thoughts on St. John's. It's a noble idea, but it just doesn't work in practice. Would Greg endorse or oppose Montessori education? I don't know. I think Montessori for kids, for children, for small children might not be a bad thing, but you know, to basically give them Aristotle's ethics and just sort of let them teach themselves, it's not a particularly good way of doing something like that. Maybe for preschool, it would be a good thing. So let's see here. I'm going to see if we've got any tokens. Folks at DLive, if you've got tokens, send them our way. I appreciate it. Sunday Sloth has donated one diamond. Can one study for an IQ test? Well, yes and no, I suppose. Ultimately, no, because it's supposed to, if it works, it's measuring your innate abilities. It's like a thermometer. You can't study to have the correct temperature when they stick the thermometer in your ear, right? And if the IQ test is working properly, you can't really study for it. It's just going to evaluate your G, your raw biological intelligence. Critiqued donated to ice cream. Thank you very much. Critique says, it's like leaving them in the hands of the tribe to educate them. I don't know about that, but look, yeah, exactly. If you know something, pass it on. Don't let people blunder around on their own, making their mistakes. One of the worst tenets of liberal psychology, and I will never stop talking about this because it needs to be said, and there are new people listening every day. One of the worst, falsest, most destructive ideas, if this is connected with education, is the idea that you can't teach values to your children. They'll just rebel. That's what they always say. You can't teach values to your children, they'll just rebel. Well, who says this? Well, it's people who want your children delivered to them at the government school as blank slates, and then they are going to write on your children. They are going to educate them, and they're going to educate them about their pronouns and global warming and global citizenship. And they don't think it's inevitable that these kids will rebel and that it's futile to try and teach them values. The people who are telling you it's futile to try and teach your children values don't think it's futile to brainwash your kids once you send them to elementary school or college. They don't think it's futile to brainwash your kids with every cartoon and every commercial that they see. The fact is that you can teach people. And the people who have the most power to teach children are the parents. The parents are most powerful. That's why they want you to basically just default on moral education, because they know how powerful parenting is, and they have other messages that they want to teach, and they want to get you out of the way. They want you to deliver your flesh and blood as a blank slate to their brainwashing factories. That's why they teach you this nonsense. The truth is that parents have the most influence over the values that their children have, the most influence over their worldviews, if they exercise that responsibility. And a lot of them just don't. They have to, though. You've got to do it. If you've got kids, I mean, there should be nothing more valuable to you than your children and their future and their souls. And you should educate them as much as you possibly can before the other people do it. And if you default, yeah, your enemies will be the ones who educate your children, and they'll come back at Christmas time from their first year of college looking like monsters on the inside and the out. So let's see if there are any more questions here. Okay. Wait, Old Man Johnson knows about Space Wolf, Terminators, and Ark. No, I don't know anything about that shit. I'm sorry. Never played any of that. I've just heard about it. Somebody told me that Matt Heimbach decided to be Orthodox Christian because he thought it was the most Warhammer 40K of the Christian sects. That's all I'm saying. Nick says that Orthodoxy is more goth and Catholicism is the most metal Christian sect. I don't know about that. I think Catholicism is the most glam rock of the Christian sects, definitely. I don't know what's metal. You know, the most metal Christian. Anyway, this is a silly conversation, but it can be entertaining. What is the most metal Christian sect? I would think it would have to be something Nordically Protestant, maybe. That's what I'm going to go with. I remember reading that only about 500 people per 100,000 actually start their own businesses, but I could be misremembering. I don't know. But the much vaunted 1% that we're supposed to hate, well, it's less than 1% probably that actually can create a real business. But, you know, people can be tradesmen. And there was a time when the majority of people were farmers, and those are small business people. I think that a lot of people can create businesses or partnerships with other people. They don't have to aim at going into the corporate world, which requires these proxy IQ tests, right? So anyway, that's my thought on that. Bartleby writes, an electrician I know lives four houses away told me he netted $127K last year. This is true. A lot of people in trades do extremely well for themselves. They have a lot more freedom because they're not in cubicles. And they're a lot more insulated from political correctness, right? There's nobody in the HR department who can fire them for their tweets. It's very, very hard if you're an independent tradesman for people to stop people from calling you when their tree needs to be felled or their plumbing needs to be unblocked or their electricity needs to come back on or their lock needs to be fixed. And if you're inclined towards being a dissident, those are the kinds of jobs you should want. And they're skilled. They engage intelligence. They require discipline. They require agency. And a lot of them can be extremely well paid. So these are things that people should definitely think about. Dawning Armor thinks Calvinist or Puritan, maybe Amish or Mennonites, the most metal. I think the early Puritans were extremely interesting. These were scary people. They were warlike and scary people. We don't know much about them. We just have pictures of them frowning in their black hats. But you read the history of the religious wars. These people were tough. This is one thing that Sorel talks about in Reflections on Violence. He talks about why he is a pessimist rather than an optimist. He doesn't believe that there's this force of progress that's going to well us up and carry us along into a better world. And he has his various reasons for this. And the third reason that he gives, as I recall, is he talks about how the most pessimistic branch of Christianity, namely Calvinism, was the most activist. You know, they believed in predestination. They believed that most people are going to hell. And yet they intensely and forcibly expanded their religion. They went to war, and he talks about how they imitated the Jews of the Old Testament and went to war in a warlike way and conquered people and imposed their religion upon others. And it's very clear that he thinks this is the model that the left should have in imposing socialism. It's not waiting for progress, which is like waiting for providence to sweep them along. It's to go to war, right? The Reflections on Violence is a book about militancy and ginning up a militant mentality. And he loved the early Calvinists because he thought they were militant men of violence. That sounds very metallic to me. A Sunday Sloth is written in with one diamond. What do you think of Miguel Serrano? I think it's Tolkien-esque fantasy literature, and it's entertaining, but I think it should be taken with a shaker of salt. I think he's fascinating. I think he was a fascinating person. I corresponded with him briefly years ago. He's dead now. And he's worth reading. Sadly, his major books, his Esoteric Hitlerism trilogy, that has been miserably translated and produced by various sort of marginal publishers. And it's very sad. But he has a book called The Serpent of Paradise. Some of his books, before it became known that he was an esoteric Hitlerist, a number of his sort of New Age books and books on mystical topics were translated and published by trade presses, things like that. And some of those books, which are very well translated, are very, very interesting. There's a wonderful book on India that I especially liked. He's an extremely talented writer and really worth looking into, especially if you're inclined towards mysticism and esoteric beliefs. He was kind of a Hindu and also a National Socialist and tried to blend those two together in a way that's somewhat different from what Savitri Devi was doing. And they corresponded briefly with one another too. Anyway, the correspondence between Savitri Devi and Serrano is at the Savitri Devi archive. So good question. Thank you very much. Friedrich writes in with 10 US dollars. Thank you very much. I've often noticed in talks with people sympathetic to our cause, but who somehow unjustly benefit from the current system, that they reject white ethnocentrism because they sense their position in society would be lower in the ethnostate. Could we ever turn these individuals? Best wishes. Well, that is one of the factors that every movement for social reform has to deal with. And that is not the people who disagree with us on principle. Those people are bad enough. We've got a lot of conversion to do. There are two kinds of people who oppose us. They're enemies that can never be us and can never really be on our side. And then there are people who are us, but they have false consciousness. There's a third group of people who are not us, but who can be allies. That's a small group. I wish it were larger. The way you win in anything is to get fewer people fighting against you and more people fighting with you. So you figure out, first of all, who your enemy is, and then you split your enemy camp. There are your enemies, and some of your enemies can be turned into neutrals or even allies. Others will remain enemies. Then there are people who are basically from your own camp. They're your own people. But for whatever reason, they are not on your side because they are brainwashed into not being on your side. And then you're pointing out that there are some who even can be sympathetic with your ideas, but they have it good under the current system and they don't want to lose what they've got. Those people simply have to be dealt with the following way. Ultimately, you're going to have to say no to these people, okay? There are only two ways you can say no. You can say a flat, hard no. Sorry, you're going to lose, but the greater good is going to be served. Tough luck. And if you resist us, we will crush you in a nice way. But we will crush you. Your resistance will not go unmet. The other way that you can say no to them is to say no. You're not going to keep your perks in the current system, but we can find a way of you prospering in the new system. You know, there are a lot of industries that benefit from globalization. You're simply going to have to say no to these people. You're simply going to have to say, in our system, you're going to be a lot poorer, but you'll still be alive if you don't oppose us, right? And if you go all out and throw your billions against us, you might lose your billions and you might end up in jail, right? You've simply got to say to the moneyed interests a hard no. You will not rule us. You will not preside and enrich yourselves and grow fatter as our race declines into detritus and extinction. You've simply got to say no to them. However, a lot of these people are talented, and honestly, they could prosper in any system. They could prosper in a pro-white capitalist system, just like they prosper in an anti-white capitalist system. And you've got to work on their imaginations, and you've got to say, well, look, you prosper because your capital is invested in industries that are sending remittances back to Mexico. Imagine if that industry that's sending remittances back to Mexico will take some of its capital and put it into, I don't know, airplanes flying these people back to Mexico permanently, or van lines moving all of these people's property back to Mexico permanently, right? There can be a big business in shipping people back. Just like there's a big business drawing them in, there can be a big business shipping them out. And if you can get people to think, you know, I can prosper in the ethnostate. I can prosper from reversing globalization, just like I've been prospering from expanding it and pushing it forward. You can flip those people on your side because ultimately all they care about is money, right? If the only thing they care about is money, then you can get a lot of them on your side. If they just want to hold on pigheadedly to their privileges and prevent the ethnostate from coming, you know, we're going to have to basically expropriate them. You know, sorry, you're out of your job. You can spend the rest of your life on the golf course, but we're not going to allow you to be a powerful figure in our society invested in things that destroy us. So yeah, we've got to take care of the oligarchs. And some of the oligarchs are our own people. Some of those oligarchs might even have various based values. They can sympathize with us on some way, levels or another. But if they're massively invested in, say, Western Union sending remittances back, they're going to oppose us on economic grounds. And we have to basically say, economic grounds are no grounds for debasing our society and destroying our race. And if you want to prosper and you've got the imagination to prosper in the ethnostate, that's where you should be putting your energy, because we're simply not going to allow you to enrich yourself by destroying our race. End of statement, period. So that's a good question. That's a good point. I have a question from Bonnie Blue Lobster. Okay, this is a new one. Greg, what are your thoughts on Drag Queen Story Hour and protests against it? Should white nationalists get out in front of these protests? Well, I sort of feel like this is a version of something we already dealt with, which is talking about the COVID thing. Okay. First of all, there's a whole range of absolutely insane things that are going on in our society that aren't specifically connected to white identity politics. Thank God there are normies out there who aren't connected to white identity politics either, who see how crazy these things are, and they want to get out and protest it. What could possibly go wrong by having a drag queen named Molesta Childs? That's actually the name of a drag queen, Molesta Childs or Sharon Needles. What could possibly go wrong having this person get up in front of a bunch of school children and they're signaling repulsively irresponsible parents and read them some politically correct storybook? What could possibly go wrong? Why does Molesta Childs want an audience of children? Nobody's asking that question or was asking that question. Now lots of people are asking that question. It's a good question to ask. And isn't it basically a sign that liberalism has long ago departed the realm of ideology and simply entered the realm of insanity, of mental illness? You know, the Drag Queen Story Hour, you know, it's maybe Richard Spencer needs a study to conclude that somehow children are being harmed by this. I don't even think we need, the burden of proof should not be our children being harmed by this. It's what possible good can something like this do? And why do these people want to be around your kids? And why do mentally ill parents want to subject their children to this? That needs to be the question. And honestly, there are enough normies now up in arms about this that I'm delighted. It is insanity. It's not the biggest form of insanity. It's not as bad as a million illegal aliens showing up on the border and being bussed into the country. You know, there are people I know who would like to come to the United States, but they can't because they don't have COVID vaccinations that don't work. Risky vaccines that don't work are required to get into the United States unless you're a million illegal aliens flooding across the border. And so my answer to the people who say, I'd like to go to the United States, but I can't, is just show up on the Mexico border and they'll usher you in. No vaccination required, right? There are huge problems in our society, much bigger problems than Drag Queen Story Hour. I applaud parents, normies who are getting on board with that. I'm happy that people with Patriotic Alternative are out there talking about it. But, you know, I don't think it's essentially our issue. It's an issue. It's a bad thing. It's a crazy thing. It's an appalling thing. But I don't think it's essentially our issue. So if you want to put time into that, maybe because you're bored with fighting immigration or something like that, or you think that this is a way of drumming up support for our cause, go ahead. But let me tell you that if you drum up opposition to this and you're working with certain normies and you say, by the way, have you heard of The Great Replacement? A lot of them are just going to run screaming from the room. Again, it's a question of how useful is entryism into these sort of adjacent right-wing hot-button activist spheres? Is it really helping us? I don't deny that it can help us, but we need to go into this very, very clear-mindedly asking, will this actually help us? Or will this just be another way that we sort of take our time and limited resources and spend them on things that are not really our issue and that other people who don't agree with us about white identity politics are actually taking good care of? So those are my thoughts on that. Mary Ann writes in. Mary Ann wants to know, what's my opinion of the Daily Beast article on the divisiveness of the Ukraine war in our circles? Time for a rematch with E. Michael Jones? Okay, well, that's two questions. I couldn't read that article. I was blocked from it by the Daily Beast. Yeah, how quickly I forget. So anyway, a friend of mine posted a link to an archived version of it, and I spent 6 minutes reading it. 6 minutes of my life I will never get back. Thank you, friend, by the way, for posting that link, because I had to read it to answer this question. I was worried about this, frankly, because I think that intelligent enemy agents could really use this against us. And so I thought, well, this could be it. This could be an intelligent enemy agent trying to use the division on the Ukraine war to stir up more polarization and ill will than already exists. So I read it. First thing I did, I control F and saw if my name was mentioned, which I always do. That's the first thing I always do. And if somebody who you know says they don't do that, who's in a position to do that and doesn't do it, they're lying to you. So anyway, I control F'd and found that I wasn't mentioned. I thought, well, I'm disappointed. And so I read through the whole thing. This lazy person, whose name I've already forgotten, who wrote this article, wasn't all that lazy. They put a lot of work into it. They spent some time on internet forums and they contacted about 5 or 6 named experts. Most of them, all of them are enemies, frankly. But the net result was just boring and flat. Basically, the only thing I took away from this, which is something I already knew, is that these people really don't like us. They really don't like us. They think we're just terrible people. And they spent most of their time just signaling how awful we are. And they let an opportunity go by that they could have exploited very, very effectively. Now, I'm not going to tell these people how they could have exploited this more effectively. That would be foolish on my part. But they certainly could have done a much better job at stirring up conflict and ill will that does exist in our circles over the Ukraine-Russia war. So I just thought it was a big waste of time. Now, is a rematch between me and E. Michael Jones in order? No, absolutely not. Here's the thing. E. Michael Jones is a towering intellectual figure in our movement. He's published numerous books, huge fat books. He's published more words than me. I might have published more books than him, but his books are really big. You can choke an ox. You can batter an ox into unconsciousness with the Jewish revolutionary spirit. It's like 6 books in one. He is a towering figure, and he is a great debater. And I went up against the very best, and I beat him. And so I see no reason to have any further debates on this matter, and no reason to have any rematches with E. Michael Jones. The issue is settled. There is no better way that this issue could have been settled, and therefore there's no need to revisit it. I won. The case is closed. So I'm just going to move on with my life. Okay. I have a couple questions here from Eric. Eric says, would you agree with this statement? There are only two demographics that understand what has happened and is currently happening in the United States, Jewish supremacists and white nationalists. Yes. In fact, I think I said that statement or something to that effect a long time ago. I think that basically Jewish supremacists and white nationalists are the only people who really understand what the stakes are in America today. We are the ones who understand what the Great Replacement is, why it's happening, who's at the core of it, and what its ultimate results are going to be. We're the only two groups who understand what's at stake. All these other groups are wandering around with their head in clouds of nonsense, basically, a propaganda that's spewed out by, a lot of people on the other side who are basically trying to keep people confused and in a fog about what politics is in America. Most politics is, as they say in wrestling, kayfabe. It's professional wrestling is just theater, right? It's theater where people go through the motions, but then at a certain point, sometimes it doesn't become theater. Somebody snaps and it gets real, right? And they can't really control for that. Of course, this is what happened with Trump. It was all fake until somebody real came in and upset their little gentleman's agreements about not running on immigration and not running on globalization, things like that. So yeah, I do think ultimately the only two groups in this society that really understand what's going on are white nationalists like us and the Jewish establishment that opposes us. All the other people don't know really what's going on. And there are all kinds of things manufactured to keep them in a fog. So Eric also asks, what are your thoughts on human trafficking of children? Well, human trafficking of children is evil, obviously. It's kidnapping and worse. It can be rape and murder and slavery and things like that. And the people who engage in this should be punished with the great severity. And how would you help the victims of these crimes? Well, first of all, we find out where they are and who's holding them and we stop them. And that's the first thing to do is to stop them from being victimized. In the long run, what do you do to help them? Well, I don't want to be overly dramatic about this. There was a woman, I forget who it was, who was writing about rape. And she said, the first thing that these rape counselors said to her is, you'll never get over this. Oh, this is the most horrible thing in the world. You'll never get over this. And her attitude was, well, wait a second here. No, I really would like to get over this. And I really am going to get beyond this. And yet there's this whole group of people in the world who the helping professions who will try and tell people, yes, you've been victimized in a terrible way. And we sympathize with you. You should do that. But the people who say you're never going to get over it, look, people get over a lot of horrible things. And it doesn't make the guilt of the people who harm them any less if they get over it somehow, if they get on with their lives, if they have a normal life. And it doesn't help the victims to tell them, along with all the sympathy and so forth, that you're never going to get over it, which is basically to say, we can't help you. Oh, we sympathize with you and we're on payroll and we're being paid to tell you this and we can't help you. I mean, that's the message when you say to people, you're never going to get beyond this. Obviously, people can get beyond it and we hope they can. And we shouldn't poison them with this overly dramatic nonsense that a lot of people in the helping professions, in the psychology and counseling professions want to push about the ability of human beings to overcome terrible things. So I think that's a very good question. And I am going to go back to entropy. Folks, get out your credit cards, go to entropystream.live/countercurrents. And if you've got a question to ask, now is the time. I'm checking over at Odyssey. Somebody asked, do you ever watch Black Pill Devin Stack's videos? No, I've never watched any of his videos. Archie says, Dennis Prager said, watch Devin Stack's videos because Prager recently laughed that Zio dominance in Hollywood has any effect on citizens. Prager's claim is one of the top 10 Jewish lies I've ever heard. Yeah, I mean, it's absurd to say. It's absurd to say that Jewish influence in the media isn't really influencing anybody. Archie says, last night Red Ice was really smooth, not too triggering, but not bland. It was encouraging. I'm a Kovax virgin, he says. Okay, well, I didn't get it either. I hesitate to try anything new. It's just my temperament. I know that these whiz kids developing these new apps and these new vaccines and things like that, they can make mistakes, especially when they're rushing things out in a panicked environment. And I just thought, I will wait for a couple hundred million people to try this out before I'm going to dip my toe in the water. And I'm glad I waited. I'm glad I waited. I didn't do this because I'm some right-wing crank who believes a lot of Alex Jones-ish stuff about vaccines and things like that. I just hung back because I'm an empiricist, right? That was basically my motivation on this matter.